I wish I had a chance to just, you know, do a couple of things over. And he said, this music isn't going to cure cancer. And, you know, he was saying that in a way that, look, don't take yourself too seriously. You have to enjoy the ride. You have to enjoy the journey. And just make sure that if you're happy when you're recording, it's going to show in the way that the emotion manifests itself. But then I got thinking about it. And I've been thinking about it for the last 3 decades that maybe there is something about music and harmony that can cure cancer or cure whatever is ailing somebody or give somebody the strength to go on.
Hello and welcome to Here's to Life with Tori Reid, presented by Victory & Noble, a storytelling company with executive producer Patrick Howell and producer Tori Reid. Here's to Life with Tori Reid was brought to you in part by...
We are pleased to share that we are staying healthy and hydrated throughout this edition of Here's to Life with Tori Reid, courtesy of our partners at Vivro Water, a sustainable solutions company that mirrors our commitment to clarity, focus, and a better world. Vivro's water solutions for business have already helped divert tens of millions of wasteful plastic bottles from landfills and waterways. Every day, Vivro systems across the globe help forward-thinking companies transform their own on-premise water into a source for pure and reliable filtered hydration. Let Vivro help you and your business leave a legacy of stewardship, health, and wellness that will literally make you feel good inside. Go to vivrowater.com, V-I-V-R-E-A-U water.com for more information.
Music. Talk about the power of music in your life. When you have Tori Sundays, you always do this thing where you're dancing, meditating, praying, and you dance, you journal, you dance, you do that dance thing that you do or whatever on Tori Sundays. So talk a little bit about the power of music in your life.
Music has always like acted as a score. Like it scored my life and experiences and beautiful moments, heartbreaking moments. There's always a song that brings up memories. I think it's like that for everybody. But if I'm feeling any kind of way, like if I need a pick-me-up or if I need comforting, if I need just about anything, I can... Oh, lately I've been playing this one song and a lot of times I feel like I just want to check out and leave this planet Earth, and then I want to just go to another galaxy. So I'll play this song, a particular playlist that I called Another Galaxy.
Yeah, but like, who's the music that's on that? Like, first of all, nobody knows that you think you're from another planet. And I don't even think it's think. I think it's a lot deeper than that. I think that you are from another galaxy. I think that you are from another planet. And I think that you know it. And I think that most people do not know that they come from these different places. But talk a little bit about that music soundtrack. Like, who's on it?
Well, the title song, the song that I completely in love with, is called Love is the Message. And it's instrumental, and it's by Yousef Days, I believe is how you pronounce his last name, and Alpha Mist, featuring Mansoor Brown. And then there are songs that, I mean, Blackbirds, Roy Ayers, Black Sabbath, there's songs from the 60s, like Stelvio Caprania. What is it? Stelvio Cipriani, I'm horrible with names. Stelvio Cipriani is called Mary's Theme, and it's from 1969. And so it's songs from the 60s, the 70s, current day. But any song that makes me feel like I leave planet Earth and I'm floating in another galaxy among the stars, other planets, I'll just play this playlist, and it's 53 songs, lasts for about 3 hours. And I typically lay on my sofa, lay on my back, and I'm just zoned out. A lot of times I'll listen to it through my speaker or I'll put on the headphones, which really makes it intense. And I just take a trip. So for me, that's healing, because that's healing my soul. It's healing my spirit. Like you said, I always felt like I'm from another planet. And
from another planet, I think evidence has been presented that you are from another planet. Yes.
Yeah.
Do you think Brent Fisher is from another planet and your limited experience with him? Actually, none of us have limited experience with him. He's the greatest artist in the history of composers that nobody knows his name. He's like the anti Quincy Jones, but everybody's been listening to him for decades, him and his dad, and nobody has the slightest clue, which is mind blowing because that means they're just about the music.
Yeah. No, I think he is. To come up with the music he comes up with, the, like you say, the arrangements, just some of our favorite songs. They're parts of songs that I've been listening to my whole life. And it was him. You know, whether it's a Prince song, whether it's D'Angelo, whether it's, I don't know, Chaka Khan, I don't know, Al Jarreau, he was behind it, which is mind-blowing. But yeah, you have to be to create certain artists. You know, I always call them my tribe, my favorite people, people I connect with, I think, on a soulful level.
Brent Fisher is a dynamic spirit and Grammy-winning producer, composer, and arranger behind the sounds of some of our favorite music compositions, like D'Angelo's Really Love from his Black Messiah album, which Brent was one of the producers, or Prince's Sign of the Times, Graffiti Bridge, Under the Cherry Moon and Parade, or perhaps any of the last 9 Clare Fisher albums, including Ritmo, the Grammy-winning Best Latin Jazz album. But Brent's also a dutiful son of the legendary Clare Fisher, who he passionately honors and proudly upholds his legacy. In fact, Brent credits his father for creating a rich harmonic and orchestration palette that has become the Fisher brand. I'm also a child who has been heavily influenced by my dad and my mom, the rich legacies they have left me and continue to leave me. Just as Brent can remember lying under his father's piano, I reminisce being on television sets with my dad and going to classrooms with my mother, a passionate master teacher, and how that has colored my very being to this day. Being a dutiful son or daughter is not always easy, but what a blessing to have a living legacy that always reminds you of your inner light and excellence. Brent makes it look easy, like a cosmic symphony, but it's the work of a lifetime.
I wanted to start with something about you that I found beautiful, just simply beautiful, and I appreciated learning more about you. You are a dutiful son, and you honor your legendary father, Clare Fisher, so richly, so brilliantly, so thoroughly, and passionately.
Thank you.
And I just wanted to start our conversation with that. You've also had many opportunities to honor him with your collaboration and since his transition, and you continue to do so by simply being in your greatness and just continuing his legacy in your own special way. Can you speak musically on how the legacy of your father's musical aesthetic plays into your own contemporary compositions?
Absolutely. Do you have 4 or 5 hours? to sum things up, my earliest memories when I was 2 years old or something are of going to lie underneath my dad's grand piano and, you know, with a family dog and just listen to him play. 1.5, 2 years old, just lie underneath the piano and just listen to him make music, writing for an album, working on whatever he had to do, practicing for his recording sessions. And so he saw I was interested in music. And he also saw that by the time I was about 5 or 6 years old, I understood that when you go into a recording studio and the red light, the recording light comes on, that you don't make a sound. You don't even unwrap something, right? Because that's all going to get picked up by the microphones. So once he knew that I understood that, I was about 5 or 6 years old, he started bringing me along with him to all these recording sessions that he did. And, you know, I watched him record TV shows, I don't know, like Mission Impossible and the Brady Bunch and, you know, all those different TV shows that he worked on in the 60s and 70s. And then movies and all this great stuff. And that just continued. I just always was around what he was doing. And he put me to work for him starting when I was 15 years old. And it just happened that he needed a bass player in his group, and my abilities on the bass were such that he could understand that I was going to be able to play what he wanted me to play. What I'd like to do for non-musicians is make an analogy. And it's like, you know, imagine when you're reading a book and you really like this book and the author is just brilliant, and the way this author is putting together the words, it's just amazing. The vivid scenes that are painted in your head all of a sudden reading in this book. And every once in a while you see a word that you maybe haven't seen since your high school vocabulary class or something like that. And you got to, you know, look it up in the dictionary or whatever, Google it to find out the meaning. But when you find out the meaning of this obscure word, then you say, wow, this is exactly the right word in combination with all these other words to give these really subtle nuances of meaning here that are so deep and rich. And that's what Clare Fischer figured out how to do with music. He's taking an amalgamation of all of his influences going back 400 years ago to Bach and Chopin, and then into Duke Ellington was a huge influence on him, especially that Duke Ellington's career was unfolding as my father was growing up. So, you know, that and Billy Strayhorn, Mead Lux Lewis, there's a Google him. Wow, great piano player from the 1920s and 30s and into the 40s. And then getting into all the other people that became his influences. So besides that, the orchestral composers, Shostakovich, Stravinsky, Bartok, and all these guys. And then once he got into the studios, finding out about Latin music, actually it was before the studios, when he was in college, he had Latino roommates. So they introduced him to this stuff. And then, you know, next thing you know, he's on tour in South America before I was even born. And he was one of the guys that brought Brazilian music here to the United States. You know, he was doing it in like 61 and 62. And then it really started, thanks to him and a few other people, it really made an impact, Brazilian music, on the American market, on the American music scene around that same time, and pretty much continues to this day. So this was all going on, and all these influences were just everything that I loved to listen to. Every time that he took me on a little tour with him where we'd be out of town for a couple of weeks during a summer break or something like that, when I could do that as a child, I had the chance to do all that, study what the other musicians were playing, learn how to do this. So when I went to college myself, I was already a working professional musician. So getting the degree just kind of helped me become more of myself. And actually, I didn't even realize that I would become a conductor and producer, and I just wanted to play bass back then. But this college education I got at Cal State University Northridge, that enabled me to do everything that I do today, plus all this work that I was doing with my dad, starting as his assistant. But then when we started working together orchestrally, and we were just in those sessions all the time, and there, it wasn't like I was taking lessons from him where he said, okay, here, I want you to do an exercise where you write this out for cello and whatever. It was just being there in the studio. And he said, now see the way I wrote for this clarinet here? And I did that specifically to be idiomatic for the instrument. So writing in a way that really brings out, that makes good use of the instruments. And all these things just like kind of add up. So getting back to the book analogy, the use of these unusual words, which in the case of Clare Fischer are unusual harmonies that he came up with, and also his choice of orchestra. You know, we didn't just like hire a 50-piece orchestra for every session. We handpicked every instrument one at a time. And that's a practice that I continue today in my own work. I want to make my sonic palette, what I'm choosing from the instruments, to be unique for each song. That's how it was for so many years. And then it led eventually to me being his co-writer for many, many years. We would work at, we had a 24-hour system going. He could write music all day, put down the pencil in the middle of a phrase. I'd come over at night, and I'd start writing all night while he was asleep. And then in the morning when I couldn't keep my eyes open any longer, I would again put the pencil down on the score paper, go home, and he would come in right in the middle of the phrase, pick up where I left off. And we did so many albums like this. By the time he had passed on, we had been working together professionally for 32 years. So I have a bunch of beautiful memories to carry me on. And not only that, but I have his music library. As somebody who was very meticulous about writing with pencil onto score paper, my dad never did computer music notation. And I've got 4,000 score pages and all sorts of other notes of music in the Claire Fisher Music Library that I can go and look at and refer to get inspiration anytime I want. And it's just a great feeling to have all that music. And we made a plan back in the 90s. He said, whether I make it to the end of this process or not, I would like you to help me record and release publicly every single song or piece that I've ever written for any instrumentation, whether it's for an orchestra or a trio, whatever. And so we put that plan into effect, and it still continues to this day. But when I was accepting the first posthumous Grammy that I was able to get for him, I said his greatest gift to me was the collection of his handwritten scores. And his music lives on in everything that I do. And I mean that sincerely.
The Claire Fisher Music Library is really about the melody between father and sons, one generation and the next. What is legacy? It's not tangible, or millions of dollars, or rolling hill estates. But it's the beauty of all things handed down to us from our parents, our ancestors, our mentors. Love, character, being led by example, teachings, wisdom, spiritual currency. Families are one of the most powerful carriers of legacy and culture from one generation to the next. There's something otherworldly about those connections that bond, bind, and mesmerize. Legacy is alive, and the inspiration that Brent takes from his father, who was influenced by Latin greats and worked directly with Dizzy Gillespie and Duke Ellington, is passed down to countless others who experience their greatness. That's legacy.
It was wonderful reading about him as well as you and stumbling upon a quote that Herbie Hancock said, I wouldn't be me if it wasn't for Claire Fisher. And that was in reference to your father's major influence on his harmonic concept.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you, how do you think the world has been impacted because of your dad's genius?
I got a chance to meet Herbie. I ran into him at the NAMM show. That's the music industry gathering once a year. Mm-hmm. And we talked a little bit about my dad, and that was great. And there have been so many other people that I come to find out later on that, how did you come up with this idea? And then this guy is talking about it, and he says, oh yeah, that was a direct result of a Claire Fisher album I heard when I was a teenager. Something like that. These people, I'm finding out about them still. Different people around the world that contact me, I'll find out about some guy in a country on the other side of the planet that I never knew existed. I mean, I know the country existed, but I didn't know about this guy.
Yes.
maybe he's a jazz pianist or he's an arranger or something like that, composer. All of a sudden I come to find that this guy is huge in his own country and maybe in his region on his continent. And he also counts Claire Fisher as a big influence. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that is a wonderful thing to hear about. And also to see where the things like the development of bossa nova and samba as being sort of brought here to the United States and becoming a part of American culture. And just like the Italians don't necessarily agree with the way Americans make pizza, I'm not sure if all the Brazilians necessarily agree with how we play bossa nova and samba up here. But I can tell you that I have taken the Claire Fisher Big Band down to Brazil to play at festivals down there. And in fact, one where most of the other groups playing were Brazilian. Mm-hmm. And we just were absolutely accepted there. We got standing ovation at the end of the show. And it was just amazing to be able to do that, to be able to go back 60 years after my dad had first been down there.
Yeah.
And to show them, here's what happened. After you gave Claire Fisher this gift, this is what he did with it. And this is what I continue to do with it.
Can you imagine going back to Brazil to share with a group of people songs, music, and compositions? In the 1970s, Claire had his own Latin salsa band that was born of his love of Latin American music. In fact, just as Herbie Hancock and Chick Corea, he was a pioneer of this musical influence on the electric keyboard.
Throughout the 80s, his albums were winning Grammys as the best jazz compositions in the world. His influence stretched to pop culture as a musical sweetener for Chaka Khan, the Jacksons, George Duke DeBarge, Atlantic Starr, Paul McCartney, and Celine Dion, just to name a few. And he had enough gold and platinum awards and nominations to cover a wall. Well, you've worked with some amazing legends and some of our beloved artists. This may be a tough question.
Okay.
But I'm going to give it a shot.
Who was my favorite? No.
Kind of, sort of. Was there an artist that inspired you in a way that no one else had? Just along the way, someone that, not so much a favorite, but the way they may have approached the creative process.
Right. Each one was special in its own way. And remember, there can be projects where, like, for instance, the work that I did for Toni Braxton, that was just basically, we had already been working for her for a while. So it was just, you know, they sent us the song, we added orchestra, mm-hmm. and then sent it back. I think, you know, maybe I spoke with Toni once on the phone, and that was just to say hi and talk about something else. That wasn't even to, you know, have a creative discussion at that point. So there are some artists that are kind of hands off, and that could be also because they're really busy in their careers. Mm-hmm. So there were other artists that I worked for. Usher. I've never met Usher. I got something from his producer. I wrote the arrangement, sent it back in, and then they released it. But as far as people that I worked with, you know, I did have, let's say, creative discussions with. The Really Love Project with D'Angelo, that was amazing because it was a long time in the making. They sent us the music in 2010. And then finally they said, okay, now we've got it into the position where we're ready for you to add orchestra. That was 2012. And then they still had, as D'Angelo said, they had it on the operating table for a little while longer. That means, you know, really tweaking the mixes and getting everything just in that right place. So we had some great creative discussions. And actually, part of our discussions were just D'Angelo asking, so what was it like to work with Prince? How was it in the studio when you were working on this album or that album? And so that was great because, you know, he was like, he's a fan of the music at the same time as he's creating it himself.
So ironic that Brent mentions this song, D'Angelo's Really Love from the Black Messiah album, because my exec producer also noted the song in Victory and Noble's first official book, Dispatches from the Vanguard, our manifesto for the global international African arts movement. That song is an anthem for the new age, the new time we're all in. That song opened all of our minds to where we are now.
I met Michael Jackson out at Neverland one time with my father. We were going to do a project that was going to be, I'm still under a non-disclosure agreement.
Yes.
With the estate. But I can say what they told me at the time that I could talk about is that we were going to do an album together. And so it was going to be my father and I writing for orchestra and whatever Michael Jackson was going to do. Now, that album unfortunately got sidetracked. And this was, I'm sorry to say, actually also towards the end of Michael Jackson's life. So all of a sudden he passes away in 2009 unexpectedly. And then I get a call like 3 months later saying, hey, we found this cassette tape of this old recording, Michael singing with this piano player, and we need orchestra added onto this. And so that was an amazing thing where I had the creative discussion with him way back years earlier, talking about how he wanted to put things together and how, you know, what his hopes and dreams were for how the orchestra was going to manifest itself in his music. So we had that creative discussion during his lifetime. And here I was putting it together after his life.
Yes.
And that was just an amazing experience to be able to do that.
I thought it was interesting that you and your father come from both classical and jazz worlds, yet you both work heavily with R&B artists, like we've been discussing, Michael Jackson, Prince, D'Angelo, Al Jarreau. I found that interesting. How did that come to be?
Well, I mean, first of all, if you want to look at it from a music history standpoint, I would say that R&B and gospel music share a lot in common with jazz. They're all basically part of the same family. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is probably why, let's say, more R&B artists than just like straight ahead pop or straight ahead rock artists have chosen to work with us, or at least those are the people that we know about that actually got to the point where, okay, I'm going to call them. Let me see if we can make this work. So there's that historical relationship. But on the other hand, I mean, I grew up listening to rock music. You know, I was at the same time I was listening to Earth, Wind, and Fire, I was listening to Van Halen. And then I was, discovering all these, I was really into progressive rock for a while. And, yes. But there was just always R&B and pop and everything mm-hmm. else that was going on. And so I've been involved in really heavy, hard rock projects too. And those are great because actually I think a lot of people have this conception of strings as being like for a ballad. And yes. I love adding orchestra to something that is high energy too. Not to take mm-hmm. away from strings being used in ballads. That's, a great deal of what I have done. But mm-hmm. to put it on something that's high energy and hard driving, again, mm-hmm. that's just that whole thing. It's a different kind of, wow, it's great to be alive feeling, that you get when you're dealing with a high energy music. I would say all these things are very much related to each other stylistically.
I was excited to talk to you today because you and I have something special in common. We're second generation and we both grew up in a family and are continuing a legacy rooted in responsibility in a way that we both adore our fathers. And we're very vocal and expressive about the respect and admiration that we have for our fathers.
Yeah.
And I enjoy listening to you talk about the journey and how that's been collaborating with your father. I'm curious, have there been any challenges in doing so, any pressure, or has it been pure joy?
Let's say there, it was interesting that right as I started working with him at age 15, that's supposed to be the time when teenagers normally rebel from their parents. The one thing I remember my father used to say, we'd be doing a performance somewhere, and he used to always say, so I've got a question for you guys out here in the audience. So parents, it's Friday night. Do you know where your teenager is and what he's up to right now? Because I do. He's standing right behind me playing bass. And so he used to love that.
Yeah.
I was working on a lot of these nights when I could have been out partying and getting into trouble and other things like that. Not that I was like a serious youth offender or anything like that. So yeah, we would have these little back and forth that happen that are a natural part of just, the father-son relationship. But it never got to the point where I can't speak to him anymore or, we'd go our separate ways. There was never that thing. Yeah, we definitely have arguments. And sometimes it would come in the studio because I would recall, because I, being a young man with a really, really good memory, I would recall some instruction that he had given to the group 2 weeks earlier. And then he was giving a different instruction to the group today. And I would say, yeah, but Dad, you said that 2 weeks ago. And then, we'd start, we'd have a little argument about it. Now that I look back at it, it was kind of silly. I think if I could just go back and tell myself, okay, so he changed his mind, right? Or maybe he forgot because he was a little older and he forgot the instruction that he'd give to the band. But this is a new instruction. So let's just do it because it's also a good idea. So anyway, you look back on all those things and you just think, that was a part of it. If you don't have that, if you don't have that back and forth every once in a while, then, disagreements, and then again, working through your disagreements and finding a way to compromise through something, or in the, the case when I was really young, it was just, okay, I got to do what he says, that's just the way it is. I'm not going to hold a grudge about it either, because when I look back on it, it was usually the right thing to do.
Yes.
There are very few times when I can listen back. I'm not one of those guys that likes to listen back to my old recordings and say, oh, why did I do that there? No, I should have done this instead. When you release music, it's the process actually of abandoning the music. And I mean that in the most respectful way, because what you're saying here is I could work on this song forever. Mm-hmm. I mean, even after I write an arrangement for somebody, those arrangements that I wrote for people in the past, I still have new ideas coming into my head. And I could put those down, if we wanted to do a remix or whatever later, I have all sorts of new ideas that could go. But it's the point of saying, okay, this is what I've come up with to this point. I'm really happy with this. I think now is the time to let go, to cut it loose, and let it be out there. And I'm very happy with all those decisions. I don't really have any times when I go back and maybe, yeah, oh, this one thing, that one thing, but not like, oh man, I wish I could have done that again. Or, oh, if I could only do it a second time. Nah, I don't want to think like that. I want to enjoy everything that it was. And that was also part of my father's approach too. Sometimes he would leave a mistake on some of his old recordings. And he would say, you know what? There's that little mistake in there, but in the grand picture, the emotional content and the groove and everything is just so great with this take. I'm going to go with it. You know, and he would do that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, art doesn't need to be perfect. You can sit and pay great attention to detail and manipulate things as much as you want and tweak and all that stuff. But it doesn't need to be absolutely perfect. It can have flaws in it, because what you look at as a flaw maybe is somebody else really likes that. You know, maybe there's a rasp in a singer's voice and they're listening back and say, oh man, I wish I, you know, my throat had been in better shape that day. But maybe somebody listens to that rasp and they say, oh God, that's the emotion right there. That just, wow, it just gets me, yeah. You know? So yeah. Who's to say one person's flaw is another person's creative masterpiece? So mm-hmm. Just let it be.
Brent Fisher lives a life that's rich with honor, responsibility, love, and legacy. And I live a life that's rooted in the same. So it's my intention, whenever possible, to lift up my father and mother in all that I do. Ah, then there's following in a parent's footsteps, doing what they do, continuing tradition, paying homage, while doing it just as good as they do it. It ain't easy. Or whether it's simply adoring them, celebrating them, honoring them, or wearing a smile when they're thought of. What a priceless blessing. What is your legacy? What are the good things your parents left you? Their principles, their journey, their pain, their wisdom, their joy, their talents, the gifts of their spirit. Step into that. And remember that our lives all mean something unique and centric to us, but are also universal in their significance. What does that mean? It means that we all have a legacy, a wonderful legacy, to embrace and to become. It's power. It's love. It's love power. Sometimes we walk in the footsteps of our parents or the greats we've never met. Sometimes we simply learn lessons from those, grow, and become better spirits because of the journey with them. Maybe it's not always sweet, but if you're evolving because of it, it's priceless. And it all becomes a part of a very rich and strong legacy, if you allow it.
Thank you for listening to Here's to Life with Tori Reed, executively produced by Patrick Howell. We hope you've enjoyed today's show. Here's to Life with Tori Reed was brought to you in part by
the Hilton Sacramento Art and West in Sacramento, California, is committed to creating a safe and relaxing experience, including delivery of a clean stay from check-in to check-out. Located a couple of exits from downtown Sacramento and California's capital, our hotel provides a world-class stay, amenities, and rooms at the center of the California experience. California is a world-class economy with visionaries, doers, and dream catchers at its heart. Our mission, as with Here's to Life and Getting Deals Done, is the highest possible expression of excellence, business moxie, humanity, and client care. As the world moves at a fast and sometimes hectic pace, we will provide you with a peace of mind. The Hilton Sacramento Art and West is here to make your experience a better one. We look forward to receiving you. I am Ginger Levert, Director of Sales and Marketing at the Hilton Sacramento Art and West. Our focus is on the customer experience and a pristine excellence. When you travel to Sacramento, stay with us and I guarantee your peace of mind.
Check back with our page, herestolifeeveryday.com, for new episodes every second and fourth Sunday of the month. And if you like this show, don't forget to hit subscribe and be sure to leave a comment, rate or review wherever you're listening, and share it if you can. So, here's to life, today and every day. So long for now.
This is Tori Reed, and this is Give Me a Minute. I needed to make a confession before I end the show. I didn't always believe in, or I should say embrace, the concept of legacy. Family has always been my everything. However, I didn't like being the shadows of my father. I ran from my name, the Reed name. I just wanted to matter. I wanted people to like me for me and not because I was the daughter of. That was very hard on my ego. I just wanted to shine. I wanted people to see my goodness or my decency. And it was always, oh, you're so-and-so's father. Oh, you're Tim's daughter. And it was just, it got to be really hard for me. So, and I have always adored my father, but now I adore the legacy. I adore being his daughter. It's one of my proudest things in my life. And I believe my minute is almost up. Had to confess that. Thank you for listening to Give Me a Minute.